told him he was on target. There was no clatter from a dropped rifle. The sniper was still armed. A moment later, a crash and grunt told the story. The sniper had decided to climb down and fell. He still had his gun, but he'd lost the advantage of surprise, and a rifle was a clumsy weapon for fighting up close. Teddy shortened the distance between them. He could make out the stocky profile as the little man struggled to his feet. At that moment, the other man charged Teddy from the side. His shadow wasn't much of a threat, but the little man was rushing him too, and he couldn't take them both at once. He had to shoot one of them. He wanted to keep the little man alive. Teddy shot his shadow in the head. No wounding, no warning shot. Teddy put him out of the way to go after his prize. The little man seemed to sense it was a real possibility that Teddy might put him out of action and capture him alive. Teddy was sure the little man didn't want that to happen. Somehow it would be worse than being shot dead. Teddy was right. The little man backed into the darkness, even with Teddy's gun trained on him. Teddy could have shot him. He sighed. He probably should have. 46. Teddy returned to Stone's house to find him and Dino having a nightcap.
"I thought we lost you,"
Dino said. "You almost did."
"What?"
"A minor incident, but would you guys mind leaving tomorrow?"
"What?"
Dino said. "Just how minor was this incident?" Stone asked. "Well, let me put it this way. I'm glad we left by separate doors." "Just what happened?" Stone said.
"What happened that we have to leave tomorrow?"
Dino said.
"I was just beginning to enjoy the place."
"And I have a dinner date," Stone said. "Why am I not surprised?" Teddy said. "I'm afraid something has come up."
"Oh?"
"I sort of killed someone."
"Sort of?"
Stone said. Dino put up his hand.
"This is not the type of thing you tell a police commissioner."
"You have jurisdiction in France?"
"Good point."
"Is that why we have to leave?" Stone said. "Because you accomplished your purpose and you are going home?"
"Not at all," Teddy said. "The man I killed is not the man who was trying to kill me." "You shot an innocent bystander?"
Dino said. "He's a member of the opposition, but he wasn't the hitman, and he wasn't the mole I was sent here to find."
"If he's not the man, why are you leaving?"
"Well, that's the thing," Teddy said.
"Uh-oh. You're not leaving, you're just sending us home. Is this for our own protection?"
"No, and I didn't say I wasn't leaving."
"You are leaving?"
"I'm getting on the plane with you."
"Why does that not sound like the same thing?"
Dino said. "Agent Felix Dressler must go home. Too many people are interested in him, and it's rendered him ineffective. So, for all intents and purposes, I'm leaving with you tomorrow." Teddy looked at Stone. "Do you have internet service here?"
"Of course. Why?"
"I need to send an email." Teddy sat down at Stone's computer and sent an encoded email to Lance. "Belt is buckled. Coming home."
"Can't they break that code?" Stone said.
"I'm sure they can."
"Then they'll know it was sent from my computer."
"Yes, which will fit in nicely with my leaving with you tomorrow." Teddy got up from the desk. "Now, do you mind if I borrow your car?"
"Of course you can borrow my car. Where are you going?"
"To send an email."
Teddy drove to the nearest hotel and used the computer in the lobby to send an encrypted message to Millie. He also sent an encrypted message to Kevin. That message was brief. A. Melvin Melbourne. B. Daniel Remington. C. Arnold Mycroft. D. Claude Fisher. Send only lowercase letter. Teddy logged off the computer, drove back to the Muse house, and returned the car keys to Stone.
All right, gentlemen, the bait is in the trap. All systems are go. We need to be all packed and ready to leave for the airport at 3 o'clock tomorrow. We need to be sure the plane is fueled up and ready to go.
That goes without saying, Stone said.
But there's a wrinkle, Teddy said.
Oh?
There are a few extra preparations for this particular flight.
Like what?
Teddy held up one finger.
Okay, he said. Here's what I need.
Joram glanced up from his computer. He had news, but he wanted to tread lightly. Aziz had texted, "Target alive, Glenville dead." Fahd, understandably, was in a mood.
"Sir," Joram said, "I have intercepted an email."
"What email?" Fahd said.
"An email to Lance Cabot, sent from Stone Barrington's computer."
"Stone Barrington emailed Lance Cabot?"
"Apparently not. The email originated from his computer, but the email is signed Felix. Isn't that the name Billy Barnett has been using?"
"What did the email say?"
"Belt is buckled. Coming home."
Fahd frowned.
"What does it mean?" Fahd said.
"I'm not sure. I'll keep watch, see what else comes in."
Fahd went back to his desk and sat thinking. He was not at all convinced.
Belt is buckled? What did that mean? Presumably that Billy Barnett had done the job. Could he possibly think Glenville was the mole, that taking him out solved the problem? No, Glenville didn't work for the CIA. He was a hired thug, plain and simple, and not a particularly good one. So why was Billy Barnett going home?
Fahd didn't care why, so long as he actually left. This email was no real indication. He needed proof. Fahd texted Aziz,
"Target may be leaving town. Be alert for trip to airport. Good if he leaves, but verify."
47. In the morning, Teddy checked in with Jacques at the café. Jacques was apologetic.
"I did the best I could. There are 3 American big game hunters scheduled to attend the panel. One is in Seattle, one is in Miami. Both are flying to Paris on the same day. They are checking into Larrington. They have no side excursions before that. The 3rd is Floyd Maitland of Dallas, Texas. He flew out 2 days ago and is currently vacationing at a beach on the Mediterranean."
"Where?"
"In Nice."
"He's already in France?"
"Yes, he plans to stay there until his flight to Paris."
Teddy smiled.
"Interesting. Do you have a picture?"
Jacques swung the laptop around and showed him.
"Maitland is a stereotypical Texan with a handlebar mustache and a Stetson hat."
"Does he always wear that hat, or just for photos?"
"I googled him and got this."
Jacques called up the images he'd saved. Apparently, Maitland always wore the hat, even in the candid shots. Blue jeans and a leather belt with a large buckle completed the picture.
"I don't suppose you have a recording of his voice?"
Jacques clicked on video and played a YouTube clip of Maitland addressing a dinner crowd of cattle ranchers.
"Tell me something. Does Maitland seem like a good guy, aside from his desire to kill defenseless animals?"
"Not at all. He's an oil man, but he's rumored to have made as much money trafficking undocumented immigrants to work as slaves on farms, in factories, or worse. A very bad man."
Teddy nodded his approval. "Listen, Jacques, I've been called home. I'll be leaving today."
"Is anything wrong?"
"Just bureaucratic bullshit. I hope to be back. Be alert for an encrypted email."
48. Millie met Lance Cabot in front of the Washington Monument.
Is this really necessary? Lance said.
Our friend thinks so, Millie said. Millie was in plain clothes and could have passed as a CIA agent. Lance wondered if that was what she was angling for.
Why, the mission is over. He's on his way home.
He emailed you directly?
That's right. Lance's face fell. Oh, shit. Millie smiled.
You figured there was no need for back channels because the job was done, which is just what he wanted it to look like. Here's the real message. He hasn't found the mole yet, but he's working on it. He hopes to have results soon.
Oh, he does he? What progress has he made?
He didn't say. He just wanted to alert you to the fact that the mole may be the least of our problems.
Lance's mouth fell open. A mole working inside the CIA is the least of our problems? What could be worse than that?
He didn't specify, but he thinks it's something big.
He told you nothing specific?
He did say people were trying to kill him.
I know how they feel, Lance said.
He didn't tell you anything about whatever it is that he thinks is more important than the job I sent him to do there?
I'm afraid not.
Did he tell you anything about the attempts on his life?
He said they failed.
No kidding. Tell me, is he actually working on this, or is he just having fun?
He says it's not fun, it's hard work, and it's dangerous, and stop griping about it and giving Millie a hard time.
He didn't say that.
Yes, he did.
He anticipated the question?
Word for word.
Millie cocked her head. Kind of makes you want to trust his instincts, don't you think?
49.
Teddy had texted Kristen, "Tied up tonight, see you tomorrow." He figured as a CIA agent she should accept that as a matter of course. As a woman, he figured, she probably wouldn't. He figured right.
"Big night last night?" Kristen said when Teddy checked in at the embassy.
Teddy shrugged.
"Average. I'm making progress."
"With whom?"
"A fat Russian spy. He was playing hard to get, but I lured him with my cipher code."
Kristen laughed.
"You're terrible."
He took her out to lunch and tried to prepare her for what was to come.
"I'll be leaving soon. I may not have a chance to say goodbye."
She frowned.
"Leaving? Why?"
"I'm not my own man. I go where they tell me."
"And they're telling you to leave?"
"They will."
"How do you know?"
"I have a feel for these things."
"Is it because of the men who tried to mug us?"
"That was just an isolated incident."
"You're lying to me."
"I wouldn't lie to you."
"Will you be back?"
"I go where they send me."
"Where are they sending you now?"
"They haven't told me yet. I just know I'll be moving on."
"Why are you so infuriating?"
"It's the nature of the job."
Their parting was civil but strained. Kristen went back to her office. Teddy made an excuse not to go back with her, not wishing to continue the conversation. He also wanted to see if he was being followed. He was, but it wasn't one of the bad guys. It was Agent Workman from the CIA station. That was interesting. Workman had followed him before, found everything there was to find, so why was he tailing Teddy again now? Despite what Kristen had said, Teddy thought the young agent had feelings for her, in which case he had to resent the hell out of Teddy. Teddy led Agent Workman in a neutral direction, neither toward the embassy nor toward his apartment, just to see if he'd tag along. He did. Teddy found that interesting. Teddy went into the first hotel he came to give the young man a thrill, and to check in on the computer. He logged on with no real expectations and discovered an encrypted email from Kevin. It read in its entirety, "C," closed parentheses. The notation "C," closed parentheses, was assigned to Arnold Mycroft.
Someone had run an internet search for Arnold Mycroft. Arnold Mycroft was the name on the passport workmen had seen in the locker. Teddy debated sending an email to Millie, but decided he didn't have time. He left the hotel and spotted workmen down the block. There was still no sign of the assassin from the night before. Teddy set off down the street. If the little hitman was around, he'd have to show himself. As Teddy walked, he could spot no one following but workmen. Perfect. Teddy reacted as if his cell phone had just rung. He jerked it out of his pocket and pretended to answer the call. He nodded and slipped the phone back in his pocket. Teddy looked around. He was near a small cafe. A row of cars were parked down the side street. One of them, an older model, had its driver's side window down. Teddy walked up to it as if he owned it, opened the door, and got in. The keys were not in the ignition, but Teddy had no trouble hot-wiring the car. He backed up and pulled out of the alley. As he turned the corner, he could see Agent Workman run out into the middle of the street hailing a cab. Teddy drove out of town. Occasionally, he could see Agent Workman's taxi following in the distance. He wasn't worried that he might lose him. Workman was a trained agent. Teddy came to a small vineyard a few miles out of town. It looked like a family-run place. Teddy could envision Mom and Pop tending the vines, and their 16-year-old daughter, barefoot with her skirt hiked up, trampling the grapes. The bottles would have hand-lettered labels dating back at least a century and passed on from generation to generation. The stomping tub was in evidence, though no one was in it. They were probably all out in the field. It didn't matter. Teddy was reacting to a non-existent cell phone message. He headed for the barn, as if that was where he had been told to go. The first room was full of wine bottles. They were empty, unused, and without labels. Most were in partitioned cardboard cases, but some had been unpacked onto rickety metal shelves. Teddy pushed on further into the barn. He found a couple of livestock stalls for either cows or horses. None were evident. At the far end of the barn, where one would least expect it, was a business office complete with phone, fax, and computer. That took Teddy aback. He couldn't recall seeing electricity coming into the barn. Either he was slipping or the wires were underground. Teddy sat down at the computer and opened their email. He pulled up a message at random and pretended to decode it. He grabbed a pencil and a piece of paper, and with quick strokes, glancing back and forth between the computer and his writing, he translated the message, which read, "Enemy wise, ditch cover." Teddy could hear the creak of floorboards in the barn. Workman was being careful, but there was no way to walk on that wooden floor without giving himself away. Teddy sat at the desk and kept up the facade of decoding. He could feel Workman's eyes on him, but no weapon. A weapon trained on him always put him on high alert. If pressed, Teddy could not say how he knew, but he did. There was a bathroom off the office, at least a half-bath with toilet and sink. Teddy got up, switched on the light, went inside, and closed the door. He could visualize Workman creeping toward the desk. Teddy gave him 10 seconds, and then came out with his gun drawn. Workman was bent over the desk, reading what Teddy had written from the email. At the sound of the door, he glanced up in alarm and saw the man with the gun. "You shouldn't have reported the name on the passport, Workman," Teddy said. "What are you talking about? You followed me home. You searched my flat. You followed me to the train station. You searched my locker. You're a professional. You didn't take any of my money, but you did look at my passport." Workman gave up the pretense. "Who are you, really? What are you doing here?" "Looking for you." Teddy gestured toward the door, and knowing he was beat, Workman began walking. Teddy followed behind, his gun still at the ready.
They were almost to the door when workmen suddenly spun around and chopped down on Teddy's gun hand. It would have worked on most men. With Teddy, workmen was lucky to graze his arm. Teddy was hoping for such a move. It would cut through pretense and shorten the discussion. Only workmen was no slouch. Even as he missed with his first move, he was drawing his own gun with his other hand. Teddy wasn't surprised. Risking exposure, the mole would have to kill him. There would be no middle ground, no wound and interrogate. Workman would go for the kill. Teddy shot first. Teddy searched Workman's body. He found nothing of interest, nothing that would indicate that he was anything other than a CIA agent. Teddy knew better. He left Agent Workman in a horse stall, covered up with hay. With luck, the family wouldn't find him until the body started to stink. 50. Teddy found Workman's cab waiting outside the vineyard gate. He paid off the driver and told him his buddy had decided to go back to town with him. Teddy drove the stolen car back to town, dropped it off near the cafe, and stopped in at the embassy. Kristen didn't seem to be around, which was a blessing. He didn't want to go through that scene again. He checked in with Norton and told him he had to leave. "So soon?" Norton said. Teddy grinned. "Yeah, I know you'll miss me. The fact is, there's nothing for me to do here, and the powers that be are pulling me out." "Well, I can't pretend I'm sorry to hear it. Nothing against you personally, but one hates to have one's department under review." Teddy shrugged and shook his head. "See, that's the problem. There's absolutely no way you can tell someone whose department isn't under review that they're not under review. Give my regards to the rest of the gang. A fine bunch, as far as I can tell. I'm sorry to see them so briefly and under such awkward circumstances." Teddy shook hands with Norton and went out. This time the little man was following him. He was scrunched down in the front seat of a car. Teddy wasn't surprised. With Workman and the other spy gone, the Syrians must be running short of personnel. The little man wasn't trying to shoot him this time, just keeping him under surveillance. Teddy figured they must have decoded the email. Plus, they hadn't yet heard about Workman. Teddy hailed a cab and took it back to his apartment, the one everyone knew about. He packed a suitcase, turned off the light, and went out. The hitman was lurking on the corner. He was short and stocky and had a hard time hiding. Clearly, he was a much better hitman than a stalker. Teddy hailed a cab and took it to Stone's Muse house. The little man climbed into his car and followed behind. Teddy paid off his cab and lugged in his suitcase, being careful to make sure the little man was only watching. There was always the chance he might try to shorten his day by getting off a shot. Stone's and Dino's bags were in the foyer. Teddy added his to the row and went in to find them enjoying one last drink. "All set?" Teddy asked. "All except for your gear," Stone said. "I figured you'd rather take it out of the safe yourself than have it lying there in the foyer." "Excellent. Well, finish your drinks and we'll head out."
"You're not in a hurry?"
Dino said. Teddy grinned.
"It's a private plane. It leaves when we do."
Teddy sat down and told them about his day. He left out killing Workman. That was something Lance needed to hear first. When they'd finished their drinks, Stone opened the safe and Teddy grabbed his gear. Stone buzzed Hugo, the gardener, handyman, and caretaker, who lived in the small apartment over the garage. He was driving them to the airport and came down to help them load their bags into the car.
"Keep your heads down as we go out the gate," Teddy said. "I don't expect anyone to take a shot at us, but it would be a hell of a way to end the trip."
No one fired at them. The little man was in his car down the block. When they pulled out of the driveway, he tagged along. The drive was uneventful. The little man kept up with them until they went through the airport gate. Then he drove parallel to them along the side road, keeping them in sight.
The Strategic Services jet was standing out in front of the hangar. Hugo drove up to it and helped them unload the car. They shook hands with him, and he drove off. Men came out of the hangar and helped them carry their bags to the plane. When they were finished, Stone tipped them and thanked them. They were immediately replaced by mechanics and servicemen who swarmed over the plane, checking every last inch. Stone, Teddy, and Dino boarded the plane while this was going on. "Where are my supplies?" Teddy asked. "Right this way," Stone said, grabbing Teddy's suitcase. Teddy hoisted his equipment bag and followed along. Stone led them to a private room in the rear of the plane. On the desk were a mechanic's tool kit and gear bag. There was also a uniform, identical to the ones the mechanics servicing the plane were wearing. Teddy changed quickly into the mechanic's outfit. With the cap on, he didn't even have to alter his appearance. He quickly unpacked his equipment bag. He put his makeup in the tool kit along with his money, passports, credentials, and burner phones. He put his wigs and weapons in the gear bag. He popped open the suitcase and added the few personal items he needed. Having the second secret apartment allowed him to travel very light. Teddy checked his appearance in the mirror. He touched it up slightly, adding a grease smear, and he was good to go. He said goodbye to Stone and Dino and joined the group of similarly dressed mechanics getting off the plane. Aziz wasn't taking anything for granted. He saw the men board the plane, and he stuck around to make sure it took off. He was not surprised by the swarm of mechanics. Anyone savvy enough to have foiled two assassination attempts would be alert to the possibility of someone sabotaging the plane. Aziz wished he'd thought to do it. Of course, it had never occurred to him that his target would still be alive. Finally, the mechanics finished their inspection and filed off the plane. The ramp was pulled away, and the door closed. After what seemed an interminable time, the plane roared to life, pulled away, and taxied down the runway. Aziz stood watching until it actually took off. Only then did he pull out his cell phone and text, "He's gone." 51. Teddy took a car service back from the airport. He got out two blocks away from the apartment no one knew about and lugged his equipment the rest of the way. He locked the door behind him and threw the bag on the bed. He stripped off his airplane mechanic's work clothes, went in the bathroom, and washed up. It took a while to get off all the grease and grime. When he was done, he dug into his equipment bag and sorted through his IDs. Dino had rented the apartment for him under the name Fenton Town, but he didn't want to be Fenton Town at the moment. He selected Devin Billingham, a bit of a mouthful, but an identity with a passport photo different enough from his current guise as Felix Dressler that no one would notice the resemblance. Teddy got his makeup kit out of the equipment bag, went in the bathroom and changed his appearance to match the photo on Devin Billingham's passport. When he was satisfied with the result, he dressed himself in a pair of loafers, casual slacks, and a polo shirt. Felix Dressler had worn a suit. Such a simple thing as a different choice of attire would go a long way toward preventing an inadvertent recognition. Teddy went out to a luggage store and bought a suitcase and a small steamer trunk with a substantial combination lock. The owner was happy to take Devin Billingham's credit card. It was perfectly valid and checked out when the owner ran it, as would any of Teddy's phony credit cards. The salesman helped Teddy carry the suitcase and trunk out to a taxi. This time Teddy had the cab take him right to the door of his apartment. There was no danger in doing so, as Devin Billingham. Teddy tipped the cabbie to carry the trunk upstairs, enough that he'd be happy, but not so much that he would tell all his friends. The moment the cabbie was gone, Teddy locked the door behind him and checked under the bed. The equipment bag was right where he'd left it. He had known it would be. It had only been an hour.
Still, he was never comfortable leaving his equipment unsecured. Now Teddy placed the equipment bag in the steamer trunk, locked it, and set the combination. He put the suitcase on the bed and packed what few clothes he had. There weren't many. He called the Hotel St. Pierre and made a reservation for the week, starting immediately. He called for a cab, met it on the street, and had the cabbie come up and help him with the luggage. He took the cab to the Pierre, checked in, and let the bellboy bring the bags up to the room. As soon as the bellboy had left, Teddy unlocked the trunk, took out the equipment bag, and selected only the essentials he was likely to use, such as his makeup kit, Devin Billingham's IDs, and Felix Dressler's credentials. He took a few burner phones, a gun with a silencer, and a shoulder holster. The rest he locked back up in the trunk. He called the front desk and had a bellboy bring up a luggage cart for the trunk. He took it down to the front desk and asked to see the manager. The desk clerk made a call, and within minutes a bald, bespectacled, well-dressed man bustled up to the desk and asked if there was anything he could do. "Actually, there is," Teddy said. "Devin Billingham. I deal in antique jewelry, the rarest of the rare. I am here from the States in pursuit of a few elusive pieces that I have had my eye on for some time. I wish to use your hotel as my base of operations. I have rented a room for the week, but I will not be here every night. Should the chambermaid report that my bed has not been slept in, please do not panic and notify the authorities or institute a search to see if I have given up the room. I haven't, so there can be no mistake. I am paying my entire bill in advance, at least the room charge for the 7 days. Is that acceptable to you?" "But of course, monsieur. If you could please convey these instructions to your staff so that I am not bothered by any nonsense while I am here, I would appreciate it." "I assure you it will be taken care of." "Thank you." Teddy stepped aside and indicated the cart. "I have already made some valuable acquisitions. Can you be responsible for placing my trunk in safekeeping?" "I will place it in the hotel safe." The manager cleared his throat. "When you say responsible, we can keep your trunk undisturbed, but you understand the hotel cannot be held liable for any jewelry that you may claim was in the trunk." "But of course," Teddy said, palming the man a 50-euro note. "I trust you to handle this discreetly. There is no reason for anyone to know how valuable the contents of the trunk actually are." The manager beamed. "There certainly is not." Teddy went out to a sporting goods store that specialized in camping gear and outdoor wear. He bought some denim shirts, blue jeans, and a wide leather belt with a large silver buckle. He bought the largest duffel bag he could find, a coil of rope, a hunting knife, plastic bags of various sizes, and extra-large twist ties. The clerk directed him to a specialty store where he found a pair of cowboy boots and a Stetson hat, as well as a Western gun belt and holster. "Costume party?" the sales clerk asked. Teddy grinned. "Doesn't everyone dress like this?" Teddy brought his purchases back to the hotel. He dined in his room while he sorted and packed. He went to bed early, awoke at 8, and caught a flight to Nice. He took a cab to Sur-la-Mer, a seaside hotel, and checked in as Devin Billingham. "Just the one night?" the clerk asked. "Wish I could stay," Teddy said ruefully. "I'm meeting a friend of mine, Floyd Maitland. Has he checked in yet?" The desk clerk consulted his computer. 2 days ago." "I don't suppose you could tell me the room number?" The clerk smiled. "It is not done." "I understand. May I leave him a note?" "But of course." Teddy took a piece of notepaper, scrawled, "Floyd, I'm here. Call me. Devon." He folded it up, wrote Floyd Maitland on it, and gave it to the desk clerk. "Can you see that he gets it?"
"Yes, of course."
As he turned to go, Teddy could see the desk clerk putting his note
in box 432. 52. Floyd Maitland leaned back in his beach chair and stroked his luxurious mustache. Floyd loved the beach, though it was hard to maintain his image there. He couldn't wear his Stetson with a bathing suit. On the other hand, he could enjoy tall, cool mixed drinks with little umbrellas in them. In a Texas barroom, he wouldn't be caught dead drinking anything but straight bourbon. The blonde waitress in the skimpy bikini that Maitland liked padded by in the sand. He waved to her. She nodded at him, but stopped to take the order of two young Frenchmen in beach chairs. He could see her laughing and flirting with them. He bawled her out when she took his order. Some nerve. She was supposed to be bending over him and giggling in that flimsy top. He had another wicked frozen concoction. By the time Maitland left the beach, he was quite loaded, which wasn't fair, somehow. He knew exactly how much bourbon he could drink. These mixed drinks snuck up on a fellow. Maitland went back to his room, hopped in the shower to wash away the sand, and dressed for dinner. It took a little longer than if he hadn't been drinking all afternoon, but a half hour later he was fully decked out in a denim shirt, blue jeans and cowboy boots, a casual ensemble that cost more than the monthly salary of one of his farmhands. He put on his Stetson hat and looked in the full-length mirror. He cut a dashing figure, if he did say so himself. He hoped that the little brunette he'd been talking to the night before would be in the bar. Of course, in the bar, he'd have to go back to bourbon. How would that mix? There was a knock on the door. Maitland frowned. He hadn't called room service. Surely he would remember that. Perhaps it was the little brunette. He'd given her his room number. No, it would be the bellboy with some annoying message or other. Maitland crossed the room, not staggering, but very aware of where he was putting his feet. He opened the door and gawked. Staring back at him was Floyd Maitland. It was like looking in a mirror. What the hell? Take off your hat. Maitland blinked stupidly. What? Take off your hat, the man said, raising his own Stetson. Maitland blindly mimicked him, raising his hat. Before Maitland had a chance to realize what was happening, his doppelganger aimed a gun at his head. It was an automatic. It had a long barrel. A silencer. Maitland had time to think, "That's not my gun," before it shot him in the head. 53. Teddy stepped into Maitland's room and closed the door. Maitland had done him the favor of falling over backward so Teddy didn't have to move the body to do so. Teddy grabbed a Do Not Disturb sign off the inside knob, opened the door, slipped it on the outside knob, and retrieved the duffel bag he'd left in the hallway. This time he closed and locked the door. Teddy grabbed a towel from the bathroom and slipped it under Maitland's head. He dug into the duffel bag and came out with a plastic bag about the size of a waste paper basket liner. He slipped it around Maitland's head and sealed it with a twist tie. Maitland's Stetson had fallen on the rug. Teddy picked it up and examined it. The hat was old and weather-beaten, clearly the man's favorite. Maitland would take pride in the fact that it was worn, proof that despite his wealth and habits, he wasn't all hat and no cattle. Teddy searched the body. Maitland's wallet was in the hip pocket of his jeans. It contained a driver's license, several credit cards, and various other cards, including a membership in the NRA. Teddy continued searching the body, but found nothing else of value. The clothes, however, were another story. Maitland's denim jacket had clearly been tailor-made and looked stylish, if such a term applied to Western wear. It had seemed fairly snug on Maitland, and Teddy figured it would fit him. He stripped it off, being careful that no blood was leaking from the plastic bag. Teddy also took off Maitland's boots. They were ornate and made out of what appeared to be the skin of a diamondback rattlesnake. He figured Maitland had a story about their provenance, probably apocryphal. Maitland's belt, though of seasoned leather and adorned with a gaudy buckle, had unfortunately been let out a few times to accommodate the man's girth. With Teddy's slimmer waist, the worn holes would be noticeable. Teddy stripped it off nonetheless. Teddy hadn't found what he was looking for, but a leather briefcase on the coffee table looked promising. He sat down and popped it open. His search was immediately rewarded. In a small outer compartment were Maitland's airline ticket and passport. That was a stroke of luck. The trip to Paris was a domestic flight. No passport would be needed, but now he had it, just in case. Now for the body. Teddy dumped everything out of the duffel bag and laid it out next to Maitland on the floor. It was a couple of feet short. Teddy knew it would be. That was why he had brought the duct tape. Teddy stripped off Maitland's pants, not that he wanted them, just to make the body easier to deal with. He folded his legs at the knee and taped his ankles to his thighs with duct tape. It was not a particularly neat job, but that didn't matter. Maitland was now short enough to fit in the duffel bag. Teddy stuffed him in and zipped it shut. Teddy called the front desk. "This is Floyd Maitland. My car's in valet parking. Could you have it brought around to the front in 15 minutes? Number? What number? Oh, the number on the stub. It's 143. Yes. And could you send a bellboy with a luggage cart up to my room?" Teddy met the bellboy at the door. He palmed him a bill and said, "Wait here." He pushed the cart into the room, closing the door, and heaved the duffel bag up on the cart. Maitland was heavy, and Teddy could have used the help, but he didn't want the bellboy to notice how much like a body his luggage actually was. Teddy let the bellboy push the cart into the elevator and take it out front, where a car was already waiting. Teddy smiled. He had expected the Texan to drive some huge gas-guzzling Cadillac, but of course it was a rental of European proportions. The trunk was barely big enough to hold the duffel. Teddy took the car keys from the valet and popped the trunk. The valet started to help him with the bag, but Teddy waved him away. "It's fragile and valuable. If it breaks, I don't want to be blaming you." Teddy hefted the duffel into the trunk and slammed it shut. He handed bills to the bellboy and the valet, hopped in the car, and drove off. It was not a scenic drive. Teddy did not follow the seashore or take in any of the well-advertised tourist spots. Instead, he took a tour of alleys and back lots, searching for a likely dumpster in which to dump the body. He found none that was either large or full enough for the duffel to go unnoticed by the garbage men. Finally, Teddy gave up and went back to the hotel. He drove up to the door, handed the keys to the valet, and told him to park it. Maitland would have to spend the night in the garage. 54. Aziz felt he'd failed, which indeed he had. Yet he gave no sign. He stood before Fahd, stolid as ever, awaiting the strong man's wrath. It did not come. Perversely, Fahd seemed quite satisfied with the situation.
"So," he said, "we are all set. The man who was causing so much trouble has left Paris and has no reason to come back. When we arrive the day after tomorrow, no one will be there to bother us. You will be on high alert, of course, but I do not expect any trouble. The men in our party are wonderful camouflage. We will seem like any other members of the convention."
Fahd looked at Aziz for approval and reassurance. Of course, he got none. He knew he wouldn't, but every now and then he couldn't help looking anyway. Fahd scooped up the phone and barked,
"Joram,
The little computer technician poked his head in the door.
"Sir?" "Joram, I need you in this chair. Why are you not in this chair?"
"Sir, you told me to go. You were meeting with the general and you did not want me present."
"Well, I am not meeting him now, am I? Do you have my itinerary for Paris, as I requested?"
"Yes, sir."
Joram sat at the computer and began typing. "What are you doing?"
"Calling it up."
"I don't want to stand here reading over your shoulder. Print it out for me."
"Yes, sir."
Joram did so and handed it to him.
"Our reservation is for you, Aziz, Dr. Habib, Dr. Chaim, and Dr. Badim. You're all registered for the conference and you paid extra for the special panel, rarest of the rare. The three doctors have airline tickets. You and Aziz will be traveling by private plane."
"Where are the airline tickets?"
"I will print out the reservations. The boarding passes I can print out 24 hours before the flight."
"Can they get their own boarding passes at the airport?"
"Yes."
"Good. I suppose even doctors can figure out how to do that."
"They've been given instructions and a travel itinerary. They understand that you will brief them on what you want them to do."
"Oh, they understand that, do they?"
"They have been told."
"Then I suppose I have to do it."
Joram felt like somehow he had done something wrong.
"Do you want me to do it for you?" he offered as a conciliatory gesture.
"You wouldn't know what to say." "No, get them in here."
"Do you want them all at once?"
"Three scientists? I'd never keep them straight. One at a time, please."
Joram sat down and started making calls. 55. Dr. Habib was concerned. He'd been delighted when he learned he was going to a rare animal convention in Paris. Less so when he learned he would be attending with Fahd, a reputed military strongman and weapons dealer, a man with no background or interest in zoology. Fahd's attendance at a conservation convention did not compute, but his orders were clear. He was to report to Fahd and receive his instructions for the trip to Paris, so he was nervous when he knocked on the door. The door was opened by a short, stocky man with a bald head. That would be Aziz. Dr. Habib had heard stories about Aziz. He hoped they weren't true. Aziz motioned Dr. Habib in, so that story at least was accurate. The little man was mute. Fahd was seated behind his desk. He did not get up to greet the doctor or offer him a chair. He just let him stand there while he finished up some paperwork. Finally, he looked up.
"And you are?"
"Dr. Habib."
Fahd consulted a paper on his desk.
"Yes, you will be going to the Rare Animal Convention in Paris."
"Yes, sir."
"As a zoologist, you must be pleased."
"I am."
"You don't sound pleased."
"I am pleased. I'm just somewhat confused. Why am I going?"
"You're going to study animals. Isn't that what zoologists do?"
"Yes, of course. I'm going with Dr. Chaim and Dr. Badim."
"How do you know that?"
"I asked."
Fahd glanced over at Joram. The computer technician was suddenly very busy studying the desktop monitor. Dr. Habib found he could not resist a little subtle digging for information. He affected a casual mien.
"Dr. Badim is a microbiologist. I wonder why he is going." "To study the animals, of course."
"Yes, I'm just concerned that he is a microbiologist. If there is any infectious disease we are on the lookout for, it would be of some concern, particularly if it was common to any specific breed of animal."
"I assure you there is not."
"It is strange, though."
"Will this prevent you from having a good time?"
"No."
Fahd cocked his head.
"Joram, would you mind working in the other room? I would like to talk to Dr. Habib alone. Someone seems to be telling people our business."
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
Joram got up and scuttled out. Now then, Fahd said, getting up from his chair and walking around the desk, I would like to allay your doubts about our project. If you have doubts, you will not have a good time. Fahd put his arm around Dr. Habib's shoulders. I'm going to let you talk to Professor Malik. He is an expert in the field and can explain the need for a microbiologist. I assure you it is nothing sinister. Aziz, would you please take Dr. Habib and introduce him to Professor Malik? Tell him he has my authority to speak freely about the conference. Fahd made a face. What am I saying? Of course you can't tell him. He's a mute, you see. Here, take him this note. Fahd went to the desk, pulled a piece of paper from a pocket notebook, and wrote, Kill him, on it. He folded it up and handed it to Aziz. Aziz nodded and led Dr. Habib out. Fahd picked up the phone and barked, Joram! Joram expected to be in serious trouble for telling the doctor who else was going with him to Paris.
Yes, sir, he said meekly. Change the itinerary. We're only taking two doctors.
56. Teddy woke up and called the front desk from his cell. This is Devin Billingham in room 308. I'm checking out. My bill's paid, and I'm leaving my keys in the room. Teddy wasn't in Devin's room. He was upstairs in Floyd Maitland's suite, and he didn't feel like dressing up like Devin Billingham just to check out. He'd already left the keys and taken his suitcase, so he just had to make the phone call. Teddy had breakfast, got Maitland's car back from valet parking, and drove down to the dock. He went into a bait-and-tackle shop and bought a fishing rod, a creel, a net, a beer cooler, and two extra-large coolers. The sales clerk grinned and inquired in halting English,
You plan on catch that much?
If your equipment's any good, Teddy told him.
Teddy found the French equivalent of a Home Depot and bought 2 50-pound bags of cement. The salesman helped him carry them out. He headed for the truck, but Teddy stopped him.
Throw them in the back seat.
The salesman was surprised.
Really? Trunk's full, Teddy told him.
After a couple of blocks, Teddy stopped, got out, and poured the cement into the two large coolers. He crumpled up the bags and threw them in a garbage can on the street corner. Teddy stopped at the first convenience store he came to and bought a bag of ice and 2 6-packs of Bud Light. He took them out to the car and filled the beer cooler. Teddy got back in the car, drove down to a marina, and rented a boat. It was expensive, even more so because he didn't want a pilot. He had to sign a zillion forms exempting liability in the event anything happened. He signed them as Floyd Maitland. If he wrecked the boat, Teddy figured, Floyd was in a lot of trouble. It was a while since Teddy had piloted a boat, but like riding a bicycle, Teddy didn't forget. A sailboat might have been trickier, but a cabin cruiser was a piece of cake. Teddy maneuvered easily through the harbor and headed for the open sea. As soon as he was more or less alone, he killed the motor, dropped anchor, and went to work. First, he took out the fishing rod, unwound the line, and cast it off the stern of the ship. He was terrible at casting, but no one was looking. He stuck the handle of the rod into one of the round metal holders built into the rail for that purpose. He left the net and the creel lying on the deck to complete the picture. He realized these were hollow gestures that would only fool the most casual inspection. There wasn't even bait on the hook. Teddy popped open the beer cooler, grabbed a few cans, and poured them out in the sea. He popped another can, chugged half of it, and poured the rest out. He tossed the empty on the deck with the others, and turned his attention to the task at hand.
Teddy unzipped the duffel and took out his tools, which he had packed carefully around the body. He took out a roll of duct tape and taped up the coolers. They had latches, but Teddy wasn't about to trust them. He wound the duct tape around the coolers, taping them crosswise and lengthwise again and again. When he was satisfied, he took out a coil of rope and fed it through the handles of the coolers. He tied it off with knots he knew would hold, whether they would have impressed a true seaman or not. He reinforced them with duct tape nonetheless. He pulled Maitland out of the duffel bag. It would have been easier to leave him in the bag, but if the body was ever discovered, the duffel could conceivably be traced back to the sporting goods store where it was purchased by Devon Billingham. That could lead to complications. Teddy tied the rope to Maitland. He tied his legs, his arms, his neck, and his body, each with a separate length of rope, so if one gave, the others wouldn't. Teddy had just finished tying up the body when he noticed a boat bearing down on him. It was still in the distance, but it was coming fast. It was a police boat, and within minutes it would be close enough for them to see what he was doing. There was nowhere to hide, not with a dead man lying face up on the deck. Teddy stooped down, grabbed the coolers, and, keeping low, heaved one after another over the side. Maitland's body skidded across the deck and disappeared in the deep. That left Teddy sprawled out on the deck. His actions would seem incomprehensible to the police in the boat. They'd want to know what he was doing. He needed a useful prop. He lunged for the beer cooler, pulled out a can, and popped the top. Teddy staggered to his feet and careened in the direction of his fishing pole, just as the police boat pulled up alongside. Teddy waved and saluted them with a beer. Whatever the police had been expecting, a drunken cowboy wasn't it. The police captain yelled something in French. Teddy yelled back, "No speaker le French." The policeman visibly rolled his eyes. "Monsieur, have you been drinking?" the police captain asked. Teddy looked surprised. He looked at the beer in his hand, then back at the officer. "No." The officer stared at him. Teddy laughed a hearty, good old boy Texan laugh. "I'm not drunk, just seasick. I love to fish, but I hate the water. And the water doesn't like me. I drink a little beer to take the edge off. I assure you, I'm not drunk." The captain frowned. "Do you have any identification?" "You bet I do. Here's my driver's license from the state of Texas, photo ID, and here's the rental agreement for the boat." The captain perused the agreement. "This is one of Francois' boats. Did you rent it from him?" "If that's his name, yes, I did."
"And he let you take it out alone?"
"He charged me enough for it."
"What security did he ask for?"
"He has my platinum card and my passport. He knows he'll get his boat back."
"Were you planning on staying out here long?"
"Not anymore, I'm not. No offense, but you guys kind of took the joy out of it."
"Just doing our job."
"Of course."
The police asked him a few more questions and let him go. Teddy knew they would. If they declared him drunk and unfit to pilot a boat, they would have to tow it in, and they didn't want to do that. As soon as the police were gone, Teddy packed up his gear to go. He cleaned up the beer cans and stowed his equipment. Without Maitland, the fishing gear fit in the duffel bag. Teddy packed up the fishing pole. He got a surprise when he pulled in the line. There was a fish on it.
57. Teddy pulled the cabin cruiser up to the dock. The man from the boat rental company was surprised to see him.
"Quitting so soon?"
"It gets boring after a while," Teddy said.
"What happened to your coolers?"
"I filled them with fish and dropped them off at the market."
Yeah, sure, Teddy grinned. All right, I filled them with beer and dropped them off at a beach party. That I can